From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, a former First Family, Jimmy Carter talks about life after the White House and his work mediating international conflicts. He also reads from his best-selling book of poems. Rosalind Carter has been studying the needs of people who provide home care for loved ones. She recently wrote a book of advice for caregivers. She'll talk with us about taking care of her 89-year-old mother. Also today, Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Exotica, which is set in a strip club. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Two Americans are being detained by Iraqi police after apparently crossing into Iraq by mistake. The Americans were taken earlier this week, but their capture was just confirmed today. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
According to both a Pentagon and State Department official, the two Americans are private citizens working for a private company based in Kuwait. The Americans do not, say the officials, work for the U.S. government. The Pentagon official said the Americans were apparently going to visit a friend near the border between Iraq and Kuwait when they got lost. Adding to the confusion, said the official, was the fact that the pair was driving a white vehicle, which U.N. troops near the border mistook for a U.N. vehicle and waved through several checkpoints. There have been negotiations for the release of the Americans, and there was hope that the Iraqis would let the pair go without delay, but there has been no movement. The U.S. has no diplomatic relations with Iraq and has been the leading force behind maintaining severe economic sanctions against them. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
The space shuttle Endeavour won't land today because of bad weather at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. NASA has ordered the Endeavour shuttle commander to keep the shuttle in orbit until tomorrow, when a landing is planned either in Florida or at California's Edwards Air Force Base. Low, dark clouds have hung over Cape Canaveral throughout the day from a storm that crossed Florida. The weather is expected to improve only slightly by tomorrow. The Senate has begun considering the line item veto. The measure would give the president authority to veto specific items in large appropriations bills. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Senate Republicans say they have a compromise on line item veto legislation they should be able to pass. The measure is based on a bill that nearly passed the Senate in 1985. Under that proposal, appropriations bills would be broken down into separate bills for each individual item of spending, which the president could then veto. Minority Leader Tom Daschle ridiculed the idea.
It's going to take a Mack truck to deliver legislation to the president from here on in. And I don't understand why advocates of paperwork reduction would want to enroll separately each and every item.
But Democrats say they'll support it if the veto authority is broadened to include tax breaks. Republican Mark Hatfield may be on the spot, however. In 1985, he led the filibuster against it, saying it was one of the most dangerous proposals in his then 19 years in Congress. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The White House is strongly opposing budget cuts sought by House Republicans. Chief of Staff Leon Panetta says the GOP's priorities are wrong. He told NBC that Republicans want to cut taxes for the wealthy at the expense of children and education. The House Budget Committee has approved $100 billion in budget cuts to be made over 5 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 2.5 points at 4,071. This is NPR. Zapatista rebels in the southern Mexican state of Chiapas say they're ready to renew direct talks with the Mexican government, but they say federal troops must first withdraw from positions occupied in a recent military advance. NPR's David Wellner reports.
The Zapatistas' much-awaited response to the government was largely conciliatory, noting that new legislation which took effect last weekend contained, quote, important and worthy elements for reestablishing a dialogue. That legislation suspends for 30 days an arrest warrant issued last month against the rebel leader known as Subcommander Marcos, and it also calls for the creation of a neutral zone where talks could be held. But the message objects to, quote, serious omissions which could be used by the army to impose insulting conditions on the talks. The Zapatistas insist they won't talk with the government until Mexican troops withdraw from territory that was held by the rebels before a government crackdown last month. The Mexican government called the rebels' message positive, but said nothing about withdrawing troops. I'm David Wellna in Mexico City.
House Speaker Newt Gingrich is denying that he used his influence to get a lucrative book deal. Gingrich says the deal with HarperCollins is a standard publishing arrangement. The speaker submitted his book proposal to the House Ethics Committee yesterday. He says it should approve the contract. Gingrich also kept his pledge to take the same percentage of royalties that Vice President Al Gore receives for his book on the environment. Gingrich gave up an initial book advance worth $4.5 million. Researchers at the Agriculture Department have apparently come up with a crop rotation system that's yielding larger winter wheat crops and an improved environment. Agriculture Research magazine says farmers in northern Colorado have been alternating winter wheat with summer crops like corn and sorghum. USDA officials say the soil residue from the summer crops helps to prevent soil erosion. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Former President Jimmy Carter is one of the most sought-after mediators in the world. In Haiti, he negotiated an agreement with the military rulers that averted a U.S. invasion. In North Korea, Carter helped defuse a nuclear crisis by getting assurances from leader Kim Il-sung that he would freeze their nuclear program and allow international inspections. More recently, Carter negotiated a ceasefire in Bosnia. His efforts have won much praise, but he's also been criticized for cutting favorable deals with dictators. Is he a stooge or a savior? Asked one Newsweek headline. In the first half of today's archive edition, Jimmy Carter talks about his role as a mediator. Then in the second half of the show, he reads from his best-selling book of poems, Always a Reckoning. Carter says that he gets calls almost every month asking him to mediate conflicts. Last January, I asked what criteria he uses when deciding if he's going to accept an invitation.
Well, the first thing is that we have to be able to induce both sides to accept our presence. Usually we get a request or an importunity from one side, and then we go to the other side and say, are you willing now for us to participate? Do you really want to resolve this problem in a peaceful way instead of through continued war or the eruption of war? That's the first step. The second step is to get permission or approval from my own government, either from the State Department or the White House. And in most cases, we are better able to get approval from the White House because the State Department is an enormous bureaucracy, and there is at least an insinuation in their mind that if some outsider comes in to address a problem, that it means that they have failed in their duties. So in most cases that have been highly publicized recently, we've had approval from President Clinton and some of his subordinates, but some opposition from other places within the government.
How often has the president turned you down when you've requested the opportunity to mediate?
Well, it's not only this president, but others as well. For instance, in the case of North Korea, we were asked for 3 years by then-President Kim Il-sung to come to Pyongyang to listen to their position and to try to resolve the increasingly challenging differences between North Korea and the United States. And when we asked for permission to go, or approval from the administration, both under President Bush and President Clinton, they said no, that it was not an appropriate time or it was too sensitive an issue for us to handle. 3 years before we went, also in Haiti, when President Aristide was forced out of office by the transitional government, later headed by President Emile Jonassin and by General Cedras, both the expelled President Aristide and the provisional government leaders who remained in Haiti asked the Carter Center to perform the services of a mediator. But for 3 years, both our own government and the United Nations said that our services were not needed. So we didn't go in either case in North Korea or in Haiti until the crisis erupted and war was imminent. In the case of Bosnia, we were asked to go to Bosnia by the Serb leaders who wanted permission to send a delegation down the plains to my home to talk to me. There I called President Clinton, told him about this request. He approved it. They came to my home, explained what they would do if I would come to Bosnia. and listen to their side, and I again got permission from the White House to go.
Now, what did the Bosnian Serbs say to you that made you take them seriously? I'm asking this in the context of knowing that Karadzic has basically reneged on nearly every agreement that he's made.
Well, he said that if I would come, he was prepared to open up relief convoys, deliveries. He was willing to open up the airport in Sarajevo. He was willing to exchange prisoners of war, and he pledged to honor human rights. And so I relayed this information, as I said, to the White House and also to the State Department. And I told him that I would only come if he demonstrated tangibly that these things were being done. And I didn't go into Bosnia until all these things were put into effect. And then I went both to Zagreb in Croatia to meet with President Tudjman and also to meet with President Izetbegovic and his associates in the Bosnian government before I went to Pale to meet with the Bosnian Serbs.
When you know that someone who you're about to negotiate with has violated all the promises they made in the past, how does that affect the way you handle the negotiations and the way you handle a promise that they're ready to make or a treaty that they're ready to offer?
Well, quite often we find that both sides violate agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And that the media coverage in our country is quite biased. We tend to have heroes and villains, and the heroes can do no wrong and the villains can do no right. What we do at the Carter Center is analyze all the world's conflicts. There are about 32 major wars now, and we try to learn on a sustained basis the causes of those conflicts, the people involved, the issues that must be addressed, and so forth. And almost invariably, these wars are civil wars within a country. And except on rare occasions where the United Nations Security Council has actually acted, it's not proper at all for a UN official even to talk to a revolutionary who's trying to overthrow a government that's a member of the United Nations. So we go where others don't want to go. And at the time we went to North Korea, there was actually a law in effect that prevented any American from going to Pyongyang to talk to the officials there. And as you know, we were on the verge of a mass invasion of Haiti when we went down to Haiti. So we try to keep an open mind, not condoning what has been done in the past, but setting up the procedure so that at the end of the mediation process, both sides win. If one side wins and the other side loses, then there's no way that an agreement can be preserved.
When you went to negotiate in Bosnia, Leon Panetta, the White House chief of staff, put it like this. He said, the Serb motives are suspect. And I'm certain many people agreed with him when he said that. You know, a lot of skeptics say that tyrants ask you to come because they think they'll get a better deal out of you. So what do you say to that?
Well, I don't have any deals to offer. And I never go without the approval of my government. And I never deviate from the policies of my government. And I'm not only very familiar with the reasons and background and personalities involved in conflicts, but I'm also very careful that I'm thoroughly familiar with my own nation's policy before I go into an arena of this kind. I've never deviated from that. Also, I don't want any authority. I have zero authority. I just go as a private citizen, as a professor at Emory University, as a member of the Carter Center. And this is very important to me. When I conclude any sort of agreement, it has to be approved word by word with the authorities in charge, both sides to a dispute, or in this particular case, by the United Nations representatives there, and also by my government.
Are there things that you can do as a mediator that a president or his staff cannot?
Sure.
What?
Well, there's a severe restraint on me when I was president and others of diplomatic niceties. And it's not appropriate even for the U.S. ambassador in Port-au-Prince. to communicate by an exchange note with the provisional government leaders in Haiti when President Aristide was in exile. So that's when I can go in, and without any restraint on me, official restraint as a private citizen, I can talk to these people, listen to them, and deal with them. The final conclusion of the agreement in Haiti was not worked out with General Cedros. It was worked out with the foreign minister, whose name was David, and also with Emil Jonassin. And their actions quite often were contrary to what the military wanted. But the point is that as I said earlier, in these civil wars, our government can only deal with the official government. And the official government in Haiti was President Aristide. And in Korea, the official government was the one in Seoul. And now, of course, things are changing. We've now recognized North Korea as a separate legitimate entity, partially as a result of my trip there. And we're opening up intersections, and I hope we'll soon have normal trade and commerce and even full ambassadors exchange.
If you were able to turn back the clock and have the knowledge and the experience as an international mediator that you have now, would you have handled the hostage negotiations with Iran any differently?
No, I tried. You know, through every possible means, official and unofficial means, I tried to negotiate with or to communicate with the Ayatollah Khomeini. But he issued orders as in his autocratic way that no Iranian was authorized to speak to anyone who represented the U.S. government in the hostage thing. So we tried to get all kinds of people to open up some sort of discussion with the Iranian officials to get our hostages out, and it was fruitless until the last few days of my presidency. The last 3 days that I was president, I never went to bed at all. I never even went over to the White House. I stayed in the Oval Office to negotiate with the Iranians indirectly through the Algerians, and it was that negotiation that finally brought about the release of the hostages. From 10 o'clock that morning until noon when I went out of office, they sat in an airplane at the end of the runway in Tehran Airport. And as soon as President Reagan was sworn in, the plane took off. But that was a result of a last-minute negotiation through the Algerians.
Jimmy Carter recorded in January. Later, he'll read from his best-selling book of poems, Always a Reckoning. Coming up next, a talk with Rosalind Carter. This is Fresh Air. Jimmy Carter has expanded and redefined the role of an ex-president. We're about to find out what former First Lady Rosalind Carter has been up to. She's personally and professionally involved in the issues surrounding caregiving, taking care of a sick loved one. Rosalind Carter is the honorary chairperson of the Rosalind Carter Institute for Human Development, which focuses on the caregiving process. When I spoke with her last fall, she had co-authored a new book for caregivers called Helping Yourself Help Others. Taking care of a sick loved one can radically change your life and alter the patterns of family life. Rosalind Carter writes that caregiving has been part of her life since she was a girl. In 1940, her father was diagnosed with leukemia. He didn't want to stay in a hospital, so her mother took care of him at home.
My mother was 34 years old when my father got sick. I was the oldest child. I was 14. My little sister was 4 with two brothers in between. And my father got sick, and he was sick maybe for about 6 months. And we were devastated, the whole family was. That's one thing that we learn in studying caregiving, is that it affects the family relationships. But we were devastated, and my mother's an only child. The next year, 11 months later, her mother died. And my grandfather came to live with us. He was the father figure in our family then for years. He lived to be 95 years old, so though in the beginning he was a lot of help, still mother was tied down to take care of him for years and years and years.
What was it like for you to have a sick father at home? Were you responsible for any of his care?
Well, of course, I tried to help Mother. I was the oldest. I was a daughter, and I found out that most caregivers are women. But Mother depended on me to help her, and I knew that he was not going to live, and of course, you just feel helpless. I used to read to him, comb his hair, or do anything I could to try to make him happy. And also, I had this terrible guilt feelings because I was only 13 years old, and as a child, I had had sometimes bad feelings about him. If he called me down or punished me or wouldn't let me go across the street to see my friend. This was when I was a little girl, little child. And I felt really guilty, thinking maybe if I had been better, he would have lived. I didn't realize until I was writing my autobiography and working through these things that's normal for children who lose a parent by death or divorce. They feel guilty, like maybe they had something to do with it. One of the things that I hope this book will do is let caregivers know that it's all right to feel, that it's perfectly normal to feel guilty, because all caregivers do. Even if they're with someone they're taking care of 24 hours a day, they feel they might do it better, or they feel guilty because they get angry with the loved one they're taking care of. All these emotions are normal, and I think it's very helpful to know that. It helped me to know that it was all right for me to feel guilty.
Did your mother ever confide in you feelings about resentment or guilt during your father's illness or during the 25 years when she cared for your grandfather?
No. She never, ever complained, never. And, of course, she was devastated, and I knew that because she cried a lot. But when my father was, when we found out he was sick, and then, of course, when he were taking care of him and so forth. When I was writing the book, I asked her one day if she ever suffered from burnout, just being completely overwhelmed and exhausted, or if she didn't ever get angry. And she said, no, Papa was good. He was just really good to take care of. And then she tucked her head a little bit and said, well, he did keep me awake all night in the middle of the night toward the end of his life. And she started talking about some things that had not been easy. But I never ever heard her complain about it before. And this was not complaining. This was trying to kind of reflective.
You grew up watching your mother care for people, first your father and then your grandfather, and I wonder how that affected your feelings about the responsibility you did or didn't want to have to care for others when you grew up.
Well, it was a terrible time of my life. I was in the eighth grade, I suppose, the seventh grade maybe, when my father died, in the eighth grade the next year, and it was like nothing good ever happened. The World War II started right in the middle of that. I look back on it as a really, really difficult time in my life. But also, I can identify with people who have to take care of somebody all the time. And I even consider myself a caregiver now because my mother is almost 89 years old. She lives alone. She drives her car, which we worry about. I know she wants me at home, and I can't be there all the time. And I feel guilty about that, although I have a brother at home who can take good care of her if she needs him. But I'm the daughter, I'm the oldest. She depended on me when my father was sick, and then to help with my grandfather, and she just likes for me to be there. So I can sympathize and understand the feelings of those who are responsible for someone else, for caring for someone else. And caregivers are affected financially, physically, emotionally when they have to take care of someone all the time. And so often are just feel they're really invisible. They feel left out because attention is almost always on the one who is ill or the one who needs care.
Could you talk a little bit about how in your own life you've decided to divide your time between the time that you give your mother to watch out for her and care for her and the time that you've, decided to spend to your work and to other aspects of your family life?
Well, we have so many things going on at the Carter Center. I'm so involved in so many programs, and my mother understands that. She likes for me to be at home, and she knows that I can't be there all the time. And as I said, I feel very guilty about it. But when I am at home, she eats lunch with me almost every day. She spends the night with me if she doesn't feel good. She's had some health problems, and sometimes she's nervous about staying alone at night. But she doesn't want me to worry about her. I do, but she doesn't want me to. But also, I have a brother at home who has fixed a room on his house so that Mother can come and be with him if she's not feeling good. She can come spend the night with him. She likes to be in her own house. It's important to me to be there with her on holidays. I'm at home maybe a third of the time. I think Jimmy says we spend about a third of our time at the Carter Center, and we travel. We have so many programs, particularly in the developing world and in our conflict resolution programs and so forth, that we have to be gone a lot.
Well, a third of the time to be home and near a parent is actually comparatively a lot of time when you think of the number of people who are living very far away.
That's right.
From their parents and maybe spend a few days a year together.
And when I'm not at home, I call her. And the time I worry about is when we are overseas. We go to Africa a lot visiting. We have health and agriculture programs there and conflict resolution programs in other places. And I can't always get her when I try. And that's when I worry about her most.
Rosalind Carter is my guest. Her new book is called Helping Yourself Help Others, a book for caregivers. I know it was a very difficult transition for you and your husband to make after Jimmy Carter lost his reelection bid. And I wonder what it's been like for you now to see him getting hailed as one of the most important former presidents in recent history, hailed for the way he's redefined the role of ex-president.
Well, of course, I think he was one of our greatest presidents, too. But most of the things that we do don't get a lot of publicity. Purposely, for instance, we work on conflict resolution and human rights, and we have 26 health programs operating out of the Carter Center, mostly in Africa, with poor in the developing countries. We have agriculture programs teaching small farmers in mostly in Africa to increase their food production. And those, if we go into those countries and the head of state gets credit for what's going on, then he really is gung-ho about the program. So we don't put our name on things like that. And with human rights efforts, if Jimmy writes a head of state, if one of the major human rights organizations comes to us and say we have a really tough problem with a head of state, then Jimmy can write him a letter or call him and say, I've heard this is going on in your country. I know it's not true. I hope you will look into it. And almost invariably that leader will either let whoever he has in prison out or try to do something to overcome that situation.
Rosalind Carter recorded last November. She co-authored a book of advice for caregivers called Helping Yourself Help Others. Coming up in the second half of our show, Jimmy Carter reads from his best-selling book of poems. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on this archive edition, a poetry reading by former President Jimmy Carter. His book of poems, Always a Reckoning, has been on the New York Times bestseller list for 6 weeks. We'll talk about why he waited till now to reveal this side of himself. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Exotica, which is set in a strip club. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The State Department says two Americans are being held by Iraq. Officials say the Americans crossed the border from Kuwait earlier in the week. The United States is asking the United Nations and Polish authorities to investigate the situation. Poland represents American interests in Iraq. Attorney General Janet Reno has denounced a move by House Republicans to slash law enforcement spending already authorized last year. She says some of those cuts in spending will reduce the ability to pay for more police officers in jails.
Proposals to scale back on our fight against violent crime just should not be on the table at this time. If we make promises, we ought to keep them. The people who know this best are America's police officers.
Reno says the plan cuts a significant part of the $30 billion that was earmarked under the anti-crime legislation adopted last year. A spokesman for the International Union of Police Associations says the Republicans' proposed $5 billion cut in law enforcement programs will reduce the Clinton administration's plan for new officers by 17,000. A U.S. District Court judge has dismissed charges against a group of anti-abortion activists who had chained themselves to the doors of a Milwaukee women's clinic last year. This is the first time a judge has ruled the federal clinic access law unconstitutional. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
There have been eight other challenges to the federal clinic access law that went into effect last May, but in previous cases, the law was upheld. In the Milwaukee case, U.S. District Judge Rudolph Randa dismissed charges against six people who blocked a clinic's entrance by welding the doors shut. Under the new law, the protesters faced up to 6 months in jail and a $10,000 fine. But late yesterday, Judge Randa said that Congress overstepped its powers when it passed a law that regulated nonviolent physical obstruction at local clinics. Anti-abortion activists have always said the law was unconstitutional. They claim the first favorable ruling for them could lead to an opportunity for the U.S. Supreme Court to review the clinic access law. But abortion rights groups believe the decision will be overturned. They're concerned it'll encourage more protests. I'm Kathy Lohr, reporting.
A fifth juror has been dismissed in the O.J. Simpson double murder trial. Judge Lance Ito hasn't given a reason, but reports indicate that files found in the juror's computer suggest he was writing a book about the trial. Meanwhile, trial proceedings were delayed this morning when authorities found a pipe bomb outside the courthouse. Bomb squad investigators blew it up. No one was hurt. Authorities say they found a note with it indicating a connection with the political strife in Northern Ireland. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow gained more than 4 points to close at 4,073. Declining issues led advances by a margin of more than 4-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR. Azerbaijan's president says government troops, after a 5-day power struggle, have killed the leader of a mutinous police force. NPR's Ann Garrels reports from Moscow.
President Gaidar Aliyev says his forces have crushed what he called a coup attempt by the rebel elite police unit. The head of the unit, Deputy Interior Minister Javadov, had called for Aliyev to quit. In what appeared to be a struggle for power more than ideology, he threatened to march his 3,000-strong police on central Baku to force Aliyev's ouster. Troops loyal to the government stormed his base outside the capital this morning, shot him dead, and though a white flag has been raised, fighting reportedly continues. Azerbaijan is rich in oil and political intrigue. Since the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, two presidents have come and gone. Aliyev, the former republic's Communist Party boss, has clung to power for 2 years, though this is the second time he's had to back his presidency with force. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
The United Nations is reportedly considering an airstrike to stop Serbian attacks near Sarajevo. Officials say they're thinking about calling in NATO air power against a Serbian gun that's violating a weapons exclusion zone around the Bosnian capital. The Serbs have been firing a 20-millimeter gun despite an ultimatum against heavy weapons near the city. Meanwhile, United Nations troops have sent tons of food to the northwestern Bosnian enclave of Bihać. Rebel Serbs in Croatia allowed a convoy to pass through their territory for the first time in 2 weeks. President Clinton and Irish Prime Minister John Bruton are urging all parties in Northern Ireland to get rid of all their weapons. The leaders issued their call at a St. Patrick's Day celebration at the White House. Mr. Clinton has been heavily criticized in Britain for granting a visa to Gerry Adams, the leader of Sinn Féin, the party allied with the Irish Republican Army. Adams and Premier Bruton are praising Mr. Clinton for his peace efforts in Northern Ireland. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Former President Jimmy Carter has done something few presidents have had the talent, inclination, or nerve to do. He's published a book of poems. It's called Always a Reckoning, and it's been on the New York Times bestseller list for 6 weeks. His poems reveal a side of him you wouldn't know from his role as a public figure. Last January, we asked him to read some poems and to talk with us about them. What do you think the assumptions are that people make when they hear a former president is also a poet?
Well, I think it's been a rare thing in history to have a president who was a published poet. I imagine a lot of folks that have been in the White House have written a poem or two.
And hid them.
And hid them, yes, or shared them with maybe a wife on Mother's Day or something of that kind. But I think to write poetry seriously is probably considered to be incompatible with being a politician who's been in the White House.
Why? Why incompatible?
Well, it's just not something that's been done in the past except a couple of times in ancient history. And my own background, of course, is in engineering and nuclear physics and not in literature. But I think people sometimes underestimate the interest that even politicians can have in the finer things of life, including poetry. I've been a poetry lover all my life, and I'm kind of an expert on some poets' works. But I think the general reaction would be, well, they'll be extremely amateurish, or they'll just be frivolous, or
inspirational, or calls to patriotism.
I think so, but I think in this particular book, I put together about 45 poems and tried to make them as diverse as I could in their character.
Well, let's have you read a poem, if you don't mind. And I'd like you to read a poem called Of My Father's Cancer and His Dreams. And you're welcome to introduce this if you'd like or to just begin the poem. But I think it would be nice for you to tell us first when you wrote it.
I've written most of these poems in the last 5 years. And what I've done ordinarily is revise each poem maybe a dozen or 20 times, trying to simplify them, make sure we had the right word and that the words were juxtaposed properly and that the lines either rhymed or didn't rhyme. In this particular poem, there are kind of slant rhymes. They're not direct rhymes, but I think the listener can probably detect them. This one is a poem about my father's last days. I was a submarine officer working under Admiral Rickover, developing the second nuclear submarine in history. And my father, I learned, was dying. And I went home to be with him. And I've tried to put myself in the position of someone who is in his or her last days on a deathbed and how they might react to the world around them. The name of this poem is Of My Father's Cancer and His Dreams. With those who love him near his bed, seldom speaking anymore. He lies too weak to raise his head, but dreams from time to time. In one, he says, he sees his wife, so proud in her white uniform, with other nurses trooping by, their girlish voices aimed to charm the young men lounging there. Then her eyes met his, and hold, a country courtship has begun. They've been together 30 years. Now she watches over him as she tries to hide her tears. All his children are at home, but wonder what they ought to say or do, either when he is awake or when he seems to fade away. They can't always be on guard, and sometimes if his mind is clear, he can grasp a whispered phrase never meant for him to hear. He just seems weaker all the time. I don't know what else to cook. He can't keep down anything. He hears a knocking on the door, voices of his friends, who bring a special cake or fresh-killed quail. They mumble out some words of love, try to learn how he might feel, and then go back to spread the word. They say he may have faded some. He'll soon give in to the rising pain and crave the needle that will numb his knowledge of a passing world and bring the consummating sleep he knows will come.
Have you read that poem? Did you read that poem to your family before publishing it?
All my family are dead. I read it to Rosalind.
Yeah, I was thinking of Rosalind.
But
yeah.
My father and my mother and both my sisters and my brother have all died with cancer. And so I don't have anyone to read it to except my wife, who's a very good editor and who is familiar with all these poems.
My guest is Jimmy Carter. He'll read more of his poems after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with former President Jimmy Carter, he's written a new book of poems called Always a Reckoning. Okay, it's time for another poem.
Okay.
I have another request.
All right.
This is called Itinerant Songsters Visit Our Village.
All right.
And it's really a poem about poetry and writing poetry and learning to write poetry.
This is really what precipitated my getting serious about writing poems. Some famous poems came down to Plains to do a reading, along with our country music singer Tom T. Hall. One of these poets was Miller Williams, who wrote the textbook used in most colleges called How Does a Poem Mean?
Do you know, by the way, let me stop you here, that his daughter Lucinda Williams is a wonderful singer and songwriter?
She is great.
I was wondering if you liked her music.
I do. I have two CDs by her, and I was very pleased when she won one of the top Grammy Awards this past year.
Yeah, right.
I'm very
right.
pleased with Lucinda. Yes, I'm glad you know that. That's
yeah.
wonderful. But Miller Williams has been a lot of help to me. But this is a poem about their coming to Plains. It's called Itinerant Songsters Visit Our Village. When some poets came to Plains one night, two with guitars, their poems taught us how to look and maybe laugh at what we were and felt and thought. After that, I rushed to write in fumbling lines why we should care about a distant starving child. I asked how we might love the fear and death of war, rejecting peace as weakness, how a poet can dare to bring forth out of memory the troubled visions buried there, and why we barely comprehend what happens out in space. I found my words would seldom flow, and then I turned to closer, simpler themes, a pony, mama as a nurse, the sight of geese, the songs of whales, a pasture gate, a racist curse, a possum hunt, a battle prayer. I learned from poetry that art is best derived from artless things, that mysteries might be explored and understood from that which springs most freely from my mind and heart.
I like this poem a lot, and I like how you describe in the poem you trying to, you know, write about great themes, war and peace and troubling visions, and then you turn to specific details and very specific things that happened to you. Tell me more about how you learned to do that in your poems.
Well, I was fumbling around trying to say great things and try to emulate famous poets, and I was having a lot of difficulty. The poems didn't quite come together, and then kind of a breakthrough occurred, and I found, as I said in the poem, that my words would seldom flow, and then I turned to simpler things about matters that really meant a lot to me. One of the poems that's my favorite is this sighting of a flock of geese that flew over the White House when I was living there, and how in a submerged submarine, we would hear the song of whales on our sonar, and how a visit to a pasture gate behind our barn was a turning point in my life on the race issue. Those simple things that meant so much to me, it became possible for me to express perhaps profound ideas and feelings and thoughts using a simple theme as a vehicle rather than a complicated theme.
Did Miller Williams give you advice about that, too?
Yes, he did. Most of my poems are factual, and Miller used to kind of make fun of me because I would be factual in my poems. He said, forget about, exactness. It's the words and the thought that means more. But he used to tease me because the poems about myself are pretty well factual.
When you're president of the United States, or you're the most, important person in the country, and you have the most power and so on. And then when, fairly late in life, you start writing poetry more seriously than you ever wrote it before.
Yes.
I mean, you're getting started, pretty late with that and everything. There might be this feeling, well, how could I possibly be any good? And as former president, I'm only allowed to do things that I can really excel in. Did you ever go through a crisis about that and think, like, if you wrote poems, they'd better be the best poems, otherwise you wouldn't be able to measure up to your own standards?
Well, I did, and I have to say that I approached it fairly tentatively. I didn't just all of a sudden decide I'm going to write a book of poems.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a few poems, and then I submitted them to magazines and to quarterlies around the country.
Anonymously?
Well, I would put Jay Carter on them, and I would ask the publishers not to reveal the fact that they came from a former president, not to mention that at all. And then there were, very helpful critical reviews, most of them, by the way, favorable, I have to say. And so I increased in my confidence with experience. And finally, I decided to take about 45 of my poems and to put them together in this book.
Well, did you get rejection slips from anybody?
Yes, a few.
Now, did that hurt a lot?
Not really, because I didn't expect very much at the beginning. I expected to be rejected, and when I did get an acceptance, it was a very pleasant surprise. I submitted a few poems to some of the more prominent magazines. And the first time I sent a few poems to my present publisher, he said that he didn't think that a poetry book was appropriate for me. And I took one of the poems out of the New Yorker magazine that I could not comprehend at all, and I sent it to him, Peter Osnos. He says he has it on his wall in his office, but it's a totally incomprehensible, ugly collection of words that has no meaning to me, no rhythm, no rhyme. The words are not even good, but it was published in the New Yorker magazine, and I don't understand that kind of poetry. So, I went through a laborious process of finally saying, okay, I'm going to publish the poems that I like. I'm going to let them be truly expressive of my inner feelings, and if people like them, fine. If they don't, okay. So far, the reviews have been quite favorable.
Now, here's another problem I could see you being up against as a former president who writes poetry. I mean, poetry is something very personal, especially if it's first-person poetry, if it's about your life as opposed to just looking outside and reflecting on nature or whatever. And as a president, it seems to me you really have to withhold a lot of who you are and what's in your heart, because it can get you in a lot of trouble.
Yes.
I mean, some of the best poetry is very dark about human character and very complicated about human emotions. And poems that are dishonest and try to make things nicer than they really are usually not good poems.
Well, there are a few negative poems in here. One is With Words We Learn to Hate. And there are others as well. I need not go down the list, but I tried to express in here some of the things that concern me about public life.
There's another poem I'm going to ask you to read called Difficult Times.
Okay. It's a very brief poem. That's the title of Difficult Times. I try to understand. I've seen you draw away and show the pain. It's hard to know what I can say to turn things right again, to have the coolness melt, to share once more the warmth we've felt.
Is that a poem to Rosalind?
Yes, when we were having some difficult times. And that first version of the poem is not this one. I rewrote it several times to simplify it and to abbreviate it. But I think we all go through those things, and there's a reaching out to someone else that can be expressed in poetry that can be expressed at least by me in prose or verbally.
So did you give her the poem after you wrote it?
Yes.
Did that help
We got along
warm things up?
Well, we're still...
We're still together.
we're now approaching our 49th wedding anniversary, so yes, it did.
Now, this is an example of a poem that I would expect you might have reservations publishing if you were in the White House. Because then I could see all the press coming and saying, well, what was the dispute about and how long did it last? You know what I mean? And it just kind of being measured and interpreted in a way that was... Both very literal and very much like the character issue as opposed to as a poem.
I don't think I could have possibly published these poems, you know, while I was still in the White House or even tried to.
And tell me why.
Well, they're too self revealing.
Mm-hmm.
And they open up questions that I don't think ought to be explored in a White House press conference. I don't mind exploring them with you because I can kind of be evasive if I want to.
And that's no comment on my skills as an interviewer, right?
That's right. You're a very good interviewer. But I, obviously, this is something that couldn't be done. If I couldn't have had time to write them when I was in the White House. These poems took a lot of work. 5 years off and on of hours and hours and hours of struggling with a line or with a word or with a concept. And they're the product of a great deal of self-examination.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Jimmy Carter recorded in January. His book of poems is called Always a Reckoning. More interviews from the archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, this being Friday, we'll be hearing from our own Elizabeth Arnold and from Major Garrett of the Washington Times wrapping up another very eventful week on Capitol Hill. This week there is some pretty serious budget cutting in the House of Representatives. We'll hear about what's happened and about the much bigger budget cuts that have been forecast and called for by House Republicans. Also, the Food and Drug Administration approves a chickenpox vaccine. We'll hear about that. And we'll also consider a possible reform that doesn't figure in the contract with America, but I thought it was time to check in on it anyway. And that is the idea frequently raised to abolish the penny.
Well, thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The 34-year-old film director Adam Egoyan was born in Cairo and raised in Canada, and his first name is spelled not like Eve's boyfriend, but like the particles that make up molecules. He was actually named in honor of Egypt's first nuclear reactor. His movies, The Adjuster, Speaking Parts, Family Viewing, and Calendar, have never reached a wide audience, but his latest has been touted as a breakthrough. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Exotica.
It could be a breakthrough, people think, because it's sexy. It takes place in the netherworld of Toronto nightclubs that feature strippers and lap dancing. But for me, Exotica is a breakthrough because it's the first Adam Egoyan film that really works. Egoyan's movies have always seemed to me aggressively enigmatic, without the substance to back up the hocus pocus. His actors are generally stiff and unappealing, and prone to long bouts of carefully lighted brooding about their inability to connect with one another. Exotica is broody and enigmatic too, but right from the beginning, Egoyan's storytelling rhythms have a new snap, and the elements he's toying with are, for once, as intriguing as he thinks they are. There's the strip club Exotica, for instance, where a beautiful young dancer named Christine has a strangely feverish relationship with one of the men she table dances for. He, it turns out, is a mysteriously overwrought tax auditor who also has a very weird relationship with a teenage babysitter. Then there's Thomas, the guy he's auditing, He's a gay pet shop owner who's running a major smuggling operation on the side. Egoyan presents all these elements as though he were doing a striptease of his own, showing a little, then covering up, giving us a view of this side and then that side. The Exotica Club is full of hidden passages and one-way mirrors, and it's run by a pregnant woman who keeps demanding that all her friends touch her bulging belly, this in contrast to her dancers, whom customers can see but never touch. The movie reaches its climax when the tortured tax auditor is thrown out of the club while Christine is dancing for him, never to be allowed back in. So he sends Thomas, the pet shop owner, to ask Christine what's going on.
The night that guy was thrown out, you were dancing for him.
His name is Francis.
Yeah. What happened?
He was a bad boy.
Well, what do you mean by that?
What do I mean?
I mean, have you danced for him before a lot?
Mm-hmm.
And has he ever been thrown out before?
No.
So what do you think happened?
He touched me. And when you're dancing for the customer, they can't touch.
That's Don McKellar as Thomas and Mia Kirshner as Christine. And you can hear that Egoyan still insists on directing his actors for maximum ominousness, not always to good effect. Still, from the movie's first few moments, his gliding camera and the cobra dance of his plot lines cast a spell. A lot of the movie's little surprises don't turn out to be all that surprising, but no matter. Exotica comes to depend less and less on tricks and more on a genuine emotional pull. By the gorgeous ending, when all the questions you thought might never be answered finally are, you feel as though you've been watching a master of the high wire make it across a canyon. In Exotica, a filmmaker who once could have been dismissed as merely arty has become, at last, a real artist.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl, technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The prison population in America nearly tripled during the 1980s, and by 1990, a quarter of young black males were in jail or prison on probation or parole. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Tonry about his new study of race, crime, and punishment. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.